Reading Young, Reading Old. Mark Twain's Diaries of Adam and Eve. This piece was written as a preface to the Diaries of Adam and Eve in the Oxford edition of The Complete Works of Mark Twain, 1996, edited by Shelley Fisher Fishkin. It appears here substantially as it did there, minus two paragraphs about the illustrations reproduced in the Oxford edition. Every tribe has its myths, and the younger members of the tribe generally get them wrong. My tribal myth of the Great Berkeley Fire of 1923 went this way. When my mother's mother-in-law, who lived near the top of Cedar Street, saw the flames sweeping over the hills straight towards the house, she put her Complete Works of Mark Twain in 25 volumes into her Model A and went away from that place. Because I was going to put that story in print, I made the mistake of checking it first with my brother Ted. In a slow, mild sort of way, Ted took it all to pieces. He said, well, Lena Brown never had a Model A. As a matter of fact, she didn't drive. The way I remember the story, he said, some fraternity boys came up the hill and got her piano out just before the fire reached that hill, and a bearskin rug and some other things. But I don't remember, he said, that anything was said about the Complete Works of Mark Twain. He and I agreed, however, that fraternity boys who would choose to rescue a piano and a bear rug from a house about to be engulfed by a fiery inferno might well have also selected the works of Mark Twain. And the peculiarity of their selection may be illuminated by the fact that the piano ended up in the fraternity house. But after the fire or during it, Lena Brown somehow rescued the bear rug and the Complete Works from her rescuers, because Ted remembers the bear, and I certainly vividly remember the Complete Works. I also remain convinced that she was very fond of them, that she would have rescued them rather than her clothes and silver and checkbook, and maybe she really did. At any rate, when she died, she left them to the family, and my brothers and I grew up with them, a full shelf of lightweight, middle-sized books in slightly pebbly and rather ratty red bindings. They are no longer, alas, in the family, but I have tracked down the edition in a library. As soon as I saw the row of red books, I said, yes, with the startled joy one would feel at seeing an adult one had loved as a child, alive and looking just as he did 50 years ago. Our set was, to the best of my knowledge, the 1917 Authorized Uniform Edition, published by Harper and Brothers and copyright by the Mark Twain Company. The only other Complete Works I recall around the house was my great-aunt Betsy's Dickens. I was proud of both sets. Complete Works and Uniform Editions are something you don't often see anymore, except in big libraries, but ordinary people used to own them and be proud of them. They have a majesty about them. Physically, they are imposing, the uniform row of bindings, the gold-stamped titles. But the true majesty of a Complete Works is spiritual. It is a great mental edifice, a house of many mansions, into which a reader can enter at any of the doors, or a young reader can climb in the windows, and wander about, experiencing magnanimity. My great-aunt was very firm about not letting us get into Dickens yet. She said nobody under 18 had any business reading Dickens. We would merely misunderstand him and so spoil the pleasure we would otherwise take in him the rest of our lives. She was right, and I am grateful. At 16, I whined till she let me read David Copperfield, but she warned me about Steerforth, lest I fall in love with him as she had done and break my heart. When Betsy died, she left me her Dickens. We had him rebound, for he had got a bit shabby traveling around the West with her for 50 or 60 years. When I take a book from that set, I think how, wherever she went, she had this immense refuge and resource with her, reliable as not much else in her life was. Except for Dickens, nobody told us not to read anything, and I burrowed headlong into every book on the shelves. If it was a story, I read it. And there stood that whole row of pebbly red books, all full of stories. Obviously, I got to Tom Sawyer very soon, and Huck Finn, and my next older brother Carl showed me the sequels, which we judged pretty inferior, critical brats that we were. After The Prince and the Pauper, I got into Life on the Mississippi and Roughing It, my prime favorite for years, and the stories, and the whole complete works, in fact, one red book after another, snap, munch, gulp, snap, munch, gulp. I didn't much like The Connecticut Yankee. The meaning of the book went right over my head. I just thought the hero was a pig-headed, loud-mouthed show-off. But a little thing like not liking a book didn't keep me from reading it, not then. It was like Brussels sprouts. Nobody could like them, but they existed. They were food. You ate them. Eating and reading were a central, essential part of life. Eating and reading can't all be Huck and corn on the cob. Some of it has to be Brussels sprouts and the Yankee. And there were plenty of good bits in the Yankee. The only one of the row of red books I ever stuck at was Joan of Arc. I just couldn't swallow her. She wouldn't go down. And I believe our set was lacking the Christian Science volume, because I don't remember even having a go at that. If it had been there, I would have chewed at it the way kids do, the way Eskimo housewives soften walrus hide, though I might not have been able to swallow it either. My memory is that it was Carl who discovered Adam's and Eve's diaries and told me to read them. I have always followed Carl's advice in reading, even after he became an English professor, because he never led me astray before he was a professor. I never would have gotten into Tom Brown's School Days, for instance, if he hadn't told me you can skip the first 60 pages, and it must have been Carl who told me to stick with Candide till I got to the person with one buttock who would make it all worthwhile. So I found the right pebbly red book and read both the diaries. I loved them instantly and permanently. And yet when I reread them this year, it was the first time for about 50 years. Not having the complete works with me throughout life, I have over the years reread only my favorites of the books, picked up here and there, and the stories contained in various collections, and none of those collections contained the diaries. This five-decade gap in time makes it irresistible to try to compare my reading of the diaries as a child with my reading of them now. The first thing to be said is that when I reread them, there did not seem to have been any gap at all. What's 50 years? Well, when it comes to some of the books one read at 5 or at 15, it's an abyss. Many books I loved and learned from have fallen into it. I absolutely cannot read The Swiss Family Robinson, and I'm amazed that I ever did. Talk about chewing walrus hide. But the diaries give me a curious feeling of constancy, almost of immortality, because they haven't changed at all. They are just as fresh and surprising as when I read them first. Nor am I sure that my reading of them is very different from what it was back then. I will try to follow that then-and-now response through three aspects of the diaries: humor, gender, and religion. Though it seems that children and adults have different senses of humor, they overlap so much, I wonder if people don't just use the same apparatus differently at different ages. At about the age I first came on the diaries, 10 or 11, I was reading the stories of James Thurber with sober, pious attention. I knew they were funny, that grown-ups laughed aloud reading them, but they didn't make me laugh. They were wonderful, mysterious tales of human behavior, like all the folk tales and stories in which people did the amazing, terrifying, inexplicable things that grown-ups do. The various night wanderings of the Thurber family in The Night the Bed Fell Down were no more and no less strange to me than the behavior of the Reed family in the first chapter of Jane Eyre. Both were fascinating descriptions of life, eyewitness accounts, guidebooks to the world awaiting me. I was much too interested to laugh. When I did laugh at Thurber was when he played with words. The man who came with the Reeves and the cook who was alarmed by the doom-shaped thing on top of the refrigerator were a source of pure delight to me, then as now. The accessibility of Mark Twain's humor to a child surely has much to do with the way he plays with language, the deadpan absurdities, the marvelous choices of word. The first time I ever read the story about the blue jay trying to fill the cabin with acorns, I nearly died. I lay on the floor gasping and writhing with joy. Even now I feel a peaceful cheer come over me when I think of that blue jay. And it's all in the way he tells it, as they say. The story is the way the story is told. Adam's diary is funny when it is funny because of the way Adam writes it. This made her sorry for the creatures which live in there, which she calls fish, for she continues to fasten names onto things that don't need them and don't come when they are called by them, which is a matter of no consequence to her, as she is such a numbskull anyway. So she got a lot of them out and brought them in last night and put them in my bed to keep warm. But I have noticed them now and then all day, and I don't see that they are any happier there than they were before, only quieter. Now that is a pure Mark Twain tour de force sentence, covering an immense amount of territory in an effortless, aimless ramble that seems to be heading nowhere in particular and ends up with breathtaking accuracy at the gold mine. Any sensible child would find that funny, perhaps not following all its divagations, but delighted by the swing of it, by the word numbskull, by the idea of putting fish in the bed. And as that child grew older and reread it, its reward would only grow. And if that grown-up child had to write an essay on the piece and therefore earnestly studied and pored over this sentence, she would end up in an unmitigated admiration of its vocabulary, syntax, pacing, sense, and rhythm. Above all, the beautiful timing of the last two words. And she would, and she does, still find it funny. Twain's humor is indestructible. Trying to make a study of the rhythms of prose last year, I analyzed a paragraph from The Jumping Frog, laboring over it, dissecting it, counting beats, grouping phrases, reducing it to a mere drum score. And even after all that mauling, every time I read it, it was as fresh-flowing and lively and amusing as ever, or more so. The prose itself is indestructible. It is all of a piece. It is a living person speaking. Mark Twain put his voice on paper with a fidelity and vitality that makes electronic recordings seem crude and quaint. I wonder if this is why we trust him, even though he lets us down so often. Lapses such as the silly stuff about Niagara in Adam's diary, evidently worked in to make it suit a publication about the falls, would make me distrust most writers. But Mark Twain's purity is unmistakable and incorruptible, which is why the lapses stick out so and yet are forgivable. I have heard a great pianist who made a great many mistakes in playing. The mistakes were of no account because the music was true. Though Mark Twain forces his humor sometimes, always his own voice comes back, comes through. And his own voice is one of hyperbole and absurdity and wild invention and absolute accuracy and truth. So all in all, my response to the humor of the diaries is very much what it was 50 years ago. This is partly because a good deal of the humor is perfectly childish. I mean that as praise. There is no meanness in it, no nudging and winking, nothing snide. Now, as then, I find Adam very funny, but so obtuse I often want to kick him rather than laugh at him. Eve isn't quite as funny, but I don't get as cross with her, so it's easier to laugh. I read the diaries before I had any personal interest, as you might say, in gender. I had noticed that there were males and females, and had learned from a useful Germanic book how babies occurred, but the whole thing was entirely remote and theoretical, about as immediately interesting to me as the Keynesian theory of economics. Latency, one of Freud's fine imaginative inventions, was more successful than most. Children used to have years of freedom before they had to start working their hormones into the kind of lascivious lather that is now expected of 10-year-olds. Anyhow, in the 1940s, gender was not a subject of discussion. Men were men, running things or in uniform, mostly. Women were women, housekeeping or in factories, mostly. And that was that. Except for a few subversives like Virginia Woolf, nobody publicly questioned the institutions and assumptions of male primacy. It was the century's low point architecturally in the construction of gender, reduced in those years to something about as spacious and comfortable as a broom closet. But the diaries date from the turn of the 19th century, a time of revolutionary inquiry into gender roles, the first age of feminism, the period of the woman suffrage movement and of the new woman, who is precisely the robust and joyously competent Eve that Mark Twain gives us. I see now in the diaries, along with a tenderness and a profound delicacy of feeling about women, a certain advocacy. Mark Twain is always on the side of the underdog, and though he believed it was and must be a man's world, he knew that women were the underdogs in it. This fine sense of justice is what gives both the diaries their moral complexity. There is an element of discomfort in them for me as a child, and I think it lies just there, in that complexity and a certain degree of self-contradiction. It is not Adam's superiority of brains or brawn that gives him his absolute advantage over Eve, but his blockish stupidity. He does not notice, does not listen, is uninterested, indifferent, dumb. He will not relate to her. She must relate herself in words and actions to him, and relate him to the rest of Eden. He is entirely satisfied with himself as he is. She must adapt her ways to him. He is immovably fixed at the center of his own attention. To live with him, she must agree to be peripheral to him, contingent, secondary. The degree of social and psychological truth in this picture of life in Eden is pretty considerable. Milton thought it was a fine arrangement. It appears Mark Twain didn't, since he shows us at the end of both diaries that although Eve has not changed much, she has changed Adam profoundly. She always was awake. He slowly, finally wakes up and does her and therefore himself justice. But isn't it too late for her? All this I think I followed pretty well and was fascinated and somewhat troubled by, though I could not have discussed it when I read the diaries as a child. Children have a seemingly innate passion for justice. They don't have to be taught it. They have to have it beaten out of them, in fact, to end up as properly prejudiced adults. Mark Twain and I both grew up in a society that cherished a visionary ideal of gender by pairs, the breadwinning, self-reliant husband and the home-dwelling, dependent wife, he the oak, she the ivy. Power his, grace hers. He works and earns. She doesn't work, but keeps his house, bears and brings up his children, and furnishes him the aesthetic and often the spiritual comforts of life. Now at this latter end of the century, the religio-political conservatives' vision of what men and women do and should do is still close to that picture, though even more remote from most people's experience than it was 50 or 100 years ago. Do Twain's Adam and Eve essentially fit this powerful stereotype, or do they vary it significantly? I think the variations are significant, even if the text fudges them in the end. Mark Twain is not supporting a gender ideal, but investigating what he sees as real differences between women and men, some of them fitting into that ideal, some in conflict with it. Eve is the intellectual in Eden, Adam the redneck. She is wildly curious and wants to learn everything, to name everything. Adam has no curiosity about anything, certain that he knows all he needs to know. She wants to talk, he wants to grunt. She is sociable, he is solitary. She prides herself on being scientific, though she settles for her own pet theory without testing it. Her method is purely intuitive and rational, without a shadow of empiricism. He thinks she ought to test her ideas, but is too lazy to do it himself. He goes over Niagara Falls in a barrel. He doesn't say why, apparently because a man does such things. Far more imaginative and influenced by the imagination than he, she does dangerous things only when she doesn't know they're dangerous. She rides tigers and talks to the serpent. She is rebellious, adventurous, and independent. He does not question authority. She is the innocent troublemaker. Her loving anarchism ruins his mindless, self-sufficient, authoritarian Eden and saves him from it. Does it save her? This spirited, intelligent, anarchic Eve reminds me of H.G. Wells's Ann Veronica, an exemplary new woman of 1909. Yet Ann Veronica's courage and curiosity finally lead her not to independence, but to wifehood. Seen as the proper and sufficient fulfillment of feminine being, we are ominously close to the Natasha syndrome, The collapse of a vivid woman character into a brood sow as soon as she marries and has children. Once she has won Adam over, once the children come, does Eve stop asking and thinking and singing and naming and venturing? We don't know. Tolstoy gives us a horrible glimpse of Natasha married. Wells tries to convince us Ann Veronica is going to be just fine. But Mark Twain tells us nothing about what Eve becomes. She falls silent. Not a good sign. After the fall, we have only Adam's voice, puzzling mightily over what kind of animal Cain is. Eve tells us only that she would love Adam even if he beat her. A very bad sign. And 40 years later, she says, "He is strong. I am weak. I am not so necessary to him as he is to me. Life without him would not be life. How could I endure it?" I don't know whether I am supposed to believe her, or can believe her. It doesn't sound like the woman I knew. Eve? Weak? Rubbish. Adam's usefulness as a helpmate is problematical. A man who, when she tells him they'll have to work for their living, decides, "She will be useful. I will superintend." A man who thinks his son is a kangaroo. Eve did need him in order to have children, and since she loves him, she would miss him. But where is the evidence that she couldn't survive without him? He would presumably have survived without her, in the brutish way he survived before her. But surely it is their interdependence that is the real point? I want now to read the diaries as a subtle, sweet-natured send-up of the strong-man, weak-woman arrangement, but I'm not sure it's possible to do so, or not entirely. It may be both a send-up and a capitulation. And Adam has the last word. "Wheresoever she was, there was Eden." But the poignancy of those words is utterly unexpected, a cry from the heart. It made me shiver as a child. It does now. I was raised as irreligious as a jackrabbit, and probably this is one reason Mark Twain made so much sense to me as a child. Descriptions of church-going interested me as the exotic rites of a foreign tribe, and nobody described church-going better than Mark Twain did. But God, as I encountered him in my reading, seemed only to cause unnecessary complications, making people fall into strange postures and do depressing things. He treated Beth March abominably, and did his best to ruin Jane Eyre's life before she traded him in for Rochester. I didn't read any of the books in which God is the main character until a few years later. I was perfectly content with books in which he didn't figure at all. Could anybody but Mark Twain have told the story of Adam and Eve without mentioning Jehovah? As a heathen child, I was entirely comfortable with his version. I took it for granted that it was the sensible one. As an ancient heathen, I still find it sensible, but can better appreciate its originality and courage, the nerve of the man, a marvelous, stunning independence of that mind. In pious, prayerful, censorious, self-righteous Christian America of 1896, or 1996 for that matter, to show God as an unnecessary hypothesis by letting Eve and Adam cast themselves out of Eden without any help at all from him, and really none from the serpent either, to put sin and salvation, love and death, in our own hands, as our own strictly human business, our responsibility. Now that's a free soul, and a brave one. What luck for a child to meet such a soul when she is young. What luck for a country to have a Mark Twain in its heart.